Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast that explores today's most pressing issues and what that means for you, your family, and community. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. It is supported in part by the Arlie Shart Fund for Climate Justice and the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans.
Hey there, welcome back. I'm Rob Virchik. This is Connect the Dots. This season, we're exploring environmental and climate justice wins across the country. How have individuals, communities, and states had an impact? And how can we replicate their achievements in other places? But before we dig into today's episode, I want to talk about cultural preservation in a segment that I'm calling Rob's Rants and Raves. I chose today's topic because when we think about the environment, we often think of the natural world, which is to say the non-human world. But of course, humans are part of our environment too. And part of what makes communities thrive, part of what makes communities healthy, is the history, the culture, the relationships that keep people together and give them a sense of purpose. So here's today's rave. It involves the National Trust for Historic Preservation. This organization just unveiled its list of America's 11 most endangered historic places. Now, you might think that sounds like a bad thing, but to be on this list can actually be a good thing. Since this list debuted in 1988, the list of America's 11 most endangered historic places has proved to be a highly effective tool for shining a light on the threats facing many of the nation's great treasures. The trust puts many treasured places on the list and then explains how they are endangered. People pay attention, word gets out, communities organize around these places that they love, and often they can do things to persuade decision makers to save those places or to protect them from encroaching development. Since its creation, this list has helped save over 350 cultural landmarks. I want to tell you just about two places that are on the list that I happen to personally know about. The first is in Seattle, Washington. I used to live in Seattle years ago and still spend quite a bit of time in Washington State. On that list is something called the Seattle Chinatown International District. It's one of the oldest Asian American neighborhoods on the entire West Coast, and the Seattle Chinatown International District, sometimes called the CID, has been the center of Seattle's Asian American life for more than a century. It's the home of many thriving communities, and it's also just a wonderful place to visit if you live in other places of the city or if you're visiting from out of town. But Seattle's Sound Transit is considering several transit expansion options that could disrupt the transportation access and cultural preservation in the CID. Now, I am a fan of Washington's Sound Transit system. I was in the city just a week ago. Took it from the airport all the way up to close to the university district, $3. People ride it, they like it, it's awesome. But when you're building complicated systems like this, it's really easy to miss some voices in the community who might be disrupted or who might have better ideas about how to accomplish the good goal. So for instance, an organization called Transit Equity for All has joined a number of other organizations to make sure that community members in the CID receive all the information about the process and have ways to make their voices heard. That helps preserve this important culture, make transportation accessible to many people, and get everyone to work on time. A second entry on the trust list of endangered places is another place I know well. It's in Louisiana, where I've lived almost 20 years. It's the west bank of a parish called St. John the Baptist. This is an area that's just chock full of history. It's a region of many small villages, farmlands, and of course, sites of former plantations where enslaved people lived, labored, and died. It's a region still studied intensely by historians and social advocates. But now, the port facility, Greenfield, Louisiana, LLC, has applied to the Army Corps of Engineers for a permit to build one of the largest grain elevators in the world. So this has brought together a coalition of local and national advocates, including many descendants of people who were enslaved in this area. And they are advocating for the Army Corps of Engineers to deny that permit. So if you ever find yourself out in Louisiana, take a drive out there. It's really interesting on the West Bank at the Mississippi River in the parish of St. John the Baptist. On today's episode, I'm speaking with Ajulo Otho, an attorney and founder of EnerWealth Solutions, a community-based solar and energy storage company in North Carolina that seeks to democratize energy decisions and give power back to the people. North Carolina is undergoing a transition to clean, renewable electricity. Unfortunately, the plan under review, which is led by Duke Energy, fails to take equity and justice into account. Now, if this plan goes into effect, low-wealth North Carolinians, who are disproportionately people of color, will face steep increases in electricity rates. And that will threaten to leave many more of them without the power they need to run their lives. What's more, the state is failing to meaningfully include these communities in its planning process, and it's not considering options of self-generated electricity. Ajulo, who serves on the board of directors of the Center for Progressive Reform, advises our center's campaign on energy justice. That campaign focuses on addressing energy equity issues by reducing barriers to public participation in the state's energy plan. And it seeks to ensure that all North Carolinians have access to affordable electricity, including electricity that they generate on their own. I talked to Ajulo about this topic, the benefits that it offers to people and the planet, and we talked about what's holding it all back. We are talking about community-based solar solutions, and I will bet that there are a lot of people listening who know what community-based means and maybe know what a solar solution means, but aren't sure about how those two things fit together. So when we are talking about community-based solar solutions, can you tell us more directly what that means?
Originally, the term would have referred to a community solar installation, which is basically a shared generating facility. You have a group of folks who subscribe to a couple of panels and they receive credit typically on their electric bill for the panels that they subscribe to. That's community solar. Community solar is an excellent model in terms of equity. In so doing, the way that it is accessible for folks who are in manufactured housing, in public housing, renters, it's the way that, you know, everyday people can access it. And now models are beginning where there's different ownership structures, including having ownership by community-based organizations or environmental justice groups interested in also generating electricity.
I think most listeners have seen at some point solar farms or some kind of an array of solar panels. They can be very large operations if they're owned by a large utility, like, for instance, Duke Energy. And these you might find out in agricultural land or whatever, but they would be far removed physically from communities that you're talking about. So what you're saying is that there might be, I don't know, like a neighborhood size community that would be bringing some of their energy, some of their electricity from solar panels that might be mounted somewhere in their community, like maybe it's on a church or maybe it's on a school or something like that. That energy not only would be transferred to the grid and accessible to the folks living there, but they would get other benefits that are financial.
It's a very simple mathematical equation, which is that the cost of per kilowatt hour producing electricity by solar energy is less than the cost per kilowatt hour that the utility charges an individual residential household. We know that because the utility buys solar energy for its own generation at a rate well below what they charge the customer at the retail rate. If that electricity was going directly to the customer at the rate at which the utility is paying for it, there's a definite guaranteed savings from day one. Part of what we're trying to do, particularly in states like ours, where we have utilities that are really the only provider of electricity by law, because they have these franchise state-sanctioned monopoly positions. In fact, where community solar exists right now, there's 73% of all the community solar is concentrated in four states in the country. And there's a reason for that. It's because the folks are able to sell directly to the consumer. There's competition in the market in that way. And also because there are more favorable state incentives for community solar. What the Inflation Reduction Act has done is somewhat harmonize that across the country by putting in place special tax credits for renewable energy generation, and will be able to help many of the states that are sort of lagging behind when it comes to allowing the retail customer to directly benefit. The Inflation Reduction Act does have tax credits in it for folks who want to buy the system outright. They've got enhanced tax credits for third parties that own the system and sell the electricity. They've also got enhanced tax credits specifically for low-income communities and former coal communities. There's also incentives that are not in the tax code, like the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. There's a lot of opportunity now to make some headway in places like where we live.
Can you tell me how you got involved?
You know, I think the turning point for me was actually coming to spend time in Louisiana after Katrina and working with an international development organization, and specifically working with communities that were heavily reliant on oil and gas and petrochemical industry for their livelihood. What we wanted to work on with community-based groups is an exploration of other types of economic activity that were more ecologically sustainable, as well as being socially inclusive. That's really what got me going down this road of looking at solar energy projects in particular as a potential way of generating economic activity in marginalized communities. Then I went on to law school and became regulatory counsel with a large solar company, and that was it. I decided that this is where I wanted to spend the rest of my professional career. I saw that in many rural places, this investment, tens of millions of dollars of investment, was the largest single investment that many of these places had seen in decades. I thought, well, now that there's this investment flowing into these places, could it be doing more? This might be an opportunity to do something different in our energy sector that was not extractive in the way that it had been. And so I began building out a model for deploying solar in rural communities.
Well, so how does this work? So I understand a large utility like Duke Energy. They're the primary utility. As you point out, they have a legal monopoly. They are legally bound to operate within the public interest. So that's Duke, okay? And then you are with EnerWealth Solutions, also existing in North Carolina, and you work, I take it, with smaller utilities. So can you tell us what EnerWealth Solutions does and then what its relationship is with other utilities that are not Duke Energy?
So EnerWealth Solutions is a solar and battery storage developer. The industry is evolving over these past few years. There's actually a term for developers like EnerWealth, which is mission-based developers, that are interested in not just sort of the provision of electricity, but how to do it in such a way that it builds greater ownership in community in ways that can lead to more beneficial impacts. So we decided to pilot our projects with a rural electric cooperative, which is a unique feature of our energy system. And there are actually 900 of them across the country. They serve the places where the large utilities just wouldn't go. They are unique in that they are primarily governed by a local board of directors and can make some decisions about their generation and the types of things that they'd like to do. And their mandate explicitly goes beyond just the provision of electricity, but also they have a direct mission to build the communities that they're in. So there was a lot of alignment between Inner Wealth and the Rural Electric Cooperative that we piloted the model with, called Roanoke Electric Cooperative, which is based in northeastern North Carolina, a very impoverished community, persistently poor counties. There are large numbers of landowners, African-American landowners there, and in some places, the majority of the population are African-American in that area. And so they had programming that was really focused on things like land retention and energy efficiency and sort of helping their consumers beyond just the provision of electricity. We built together some community solar arrays where their members could subscribe to the community solar in exchange for a bill credit on their electricity bill, or they could decide that that credit could be used instead for some energy efficiency upgrade to their home. And so the savings that the utility realized by generating electricity using solar and battery storage, they funneled right back into their community.
Well, I was going to ask about that because sometimes when I'm meeting people or talking about the electricity grid, I'm often asked whether it makes a difference that a utility is public or nonprofit or for profit.
I think it does matter. I believe that the nonprofit model is one that has the most flexibility for the utility to be able to reinvest savings back into the community. The rural electric cooperatives, if they have even a surplus, they actually do a dividend back to all of their members. It would seem to me that the nonprofit model meets best, particularly when you think about energy as a right and something that all of us should be able to have reliably, particularly in the United States. Things like the cost of electricity and what we call energy burden are important.
You mentioned efficiency. You've mentioned efficiency a few times. And so, one way of having more energy on the grid is to create more energy generation, which is what the solar farms are doing. But another way to make sure that you have more energy on the grid is to make sure that people are using it as efficiently as they can and that they're not overusing, if you will, electricity.
It is a huge part of the equation. There's a lot of leakage that happens in our buildings and our homes. And many folks in the energy sector will tell you that energy efficiency is really the low-hanging fruit. We use less and therefore we need less. And that is a way to also decarbonize the electric grid. I've heard of many people who are in low-wealth communities and in rural places where they will only be in one room of the home during heating or cooling season because they just can't afford to cool or heat the rest of the home. Folks who, as a result of redlining are in less efficient dwelling spaces could benefit from energy efficiency. And so in the Inflation Reduction Act, there's also been a doubling or tripling of the weatherization assistance programs that all states, all counties have for people. And more places are starting to take this on. And even the utilities themselves have programs that are focused on energy efficiency. But what they're finding is that there's little uptake because folks, one, are still having to shoulder the upfront burden of paying for these. And so some utilities like Roanoke have implemented a pay-as-you-save program, which allows the homeowner to go ahead and make the investment. And then there's a small tariff attached to the electric bill to cover the cost of that investment over time. But the beauty of the pay-as-you-save program is that there has to be at least a 20% savings from day one before they will make that investment. The problem that we're finding with the pay-as-you-save program and also with other energy efficiency programs is that folks are living in dwellings where you actually cannot make the investment because there are issues that are bigger than that. There's a broken floorboard or mold remediation or roof issues. They need to be fixed first before you can put in a smart thermostat or a smart water heater. In fact, Roanoke has found that some 50% of the applicants to their energy efficiency program are ineligible for that reason.
You know, that's a really interesting point. At Center for Progressive Reform, a former scholar of ours, Shalonda Baker, is now at the Department of Energy. And I know from her work that one of the challenges of the Biden administration, which is promised to make sure that 40% of the benefits of these investments go to historically disadvantaged communities, one of the problems with that is making sure that there is enough capacity within those communities. Are you involved in helping build capacity in communities?
Yes, absolutely. We're so grateful that we were able to get the Inflation Reduction Act passed. And now we have to figure out how to actually access those funds. Philanthropy in particular is coming together to think about how to build capacity with community-based organizations. The EPA has also put forward requests for statewide organizations to come forward to help build that capacity. There is definitely a recognition that that has to be done in order for these dollars to actually flow to the places where they're intended to go.
North Carolina, like Louisiana and like a number of other states, is not widely known for sustainability efforts or for climate change planning. How have you navigated that in your particular situation?
You know, as a business owner in this space, we really are obligated to not just sort of run business as usual, but to be involved in advocacy and shaping policy. But just to step back a moment, North Carolina was actually second in the country in terms of installed solar capacity. We've slipped a couple of spots, but we're still in the top five. The way that solar has been deployed in our state, though, is completely different than the way that it was deployed in places like California. Here you do find almost exclusively large utility scale installations. Where we're lacking is on the distributed generation side, which is on folks' rooftop, community scale, community solar. There's very little of that. And that's where we actually need to expand the marketplace. And part of it is that our experience with solar has not been impactful in a positive way. Most folks see it as you drive by. They understand that it's there, but don't really understand what it's for. And it certainly doesn't show up in any meaningful way on their electric bill. And so it's becoming actually critically important that this technology have some meaningful impact for everyday people.
Well, I'm glad you point that out. So there is good penetration, I guess, as you say, of solar in North Carolina. And I assume that the reason for that is a business argument, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so then the question is, who gets the savings? I talk to people sometimes about sort of the solar energy model. And one of the things that I hear is that the most efficient way to generate solar energy is on large scales. And that although it's good to have solar panels on household roofs and in small scale, that it's actually more expensive per kilowatt to generate electricity that way, and that it would be better to do it large scale. Another thing that I hear is that it's not always aesthetically pleasing. And then I sometimes get people who ask me, well, what happens when a big storm comes? Do these things blow off the roofs and so on? So I think I know the answer to that one, but I'm going to put that one here too. So how do you respond to those concerns?
I completely understand. Yes, it is cheaper to build larger. As with anything, you achieve some efficiencies of scale. However, you still can achieve meaningful savings with a rooftop installation, even more so now. I understand the aesthetic issue, and I think what we are moving towards is smaller scale installations that are co-located alongside agricultural production. We, of course, have large big box retailers with lots of roof space. We've got parking lots that could be canopied. Because of the investments that are being made in the technology, panel sizes will change. There will likely be more building integrated technology. So we'll see it change over time. The mindset shift, though, is that the sun is an abundant resource that we should all be able to benefit from.
And they don't blow off the roofs, do they?
No, they don't blow off the roofs.
My neighbor has solar panels on his roof. I'm here to say we both went through Hurricane Ida when it came through New Orleans, and I was impressed. And the other thing is worth saying is that these ways of generating power aren't always very affected by storms the way that a flooded gas facility might be when pumps fail or those sorts of things. So
it can't
be more reliable during times of catastrophic weather. The other thing that I hear too is it's only sunny during the daytime and not in the nighttime. One of the issues is storage. How else might you address that problem? Maybe through reducing demand, I suppose, at peak times.
And our cars will be a source of that battery storage.
Right. And so that's an issue too, to make sure that these electric vehicle charging stations are available.
And that really is sort of the whole impetus behind why CPR is working on this issue here in North Carolina. There are multiple benefits, and we just don't want to see people left behind in this transition. We actually have found that right now, most of the residential installations are with higher wealth white families.
How has the Center for Progressive Reform, our policy analysts and scholars, how have they contributed?
So they've kicked off what they've called a campaign for energy justice in North Carolina. And the starting point for that was our carbon plan, which was mandated by our General Assembly, that Duke Energy reduce their carbon by 70% by 2030. And they required that our Utilities Commission come up with the plan. And so there was a process of public participation, which could have been much improved, which the Center for Progressive Reform helped to sort of highlight the need for greater participation. CPR also supported the intervention directly in the docket to provide comments around this issue of look at the demand side, look at customers as a way of helping to decarbonize the grid by supporting more customer-owned generation and really trying to influence our policymakers to consider this.
This is about democracy, right? Energy democracy.
That's right.
is a phrase I learned from Shalonda Baker years ago. Utilities are working in the public interest. They are regulated by these public utility commissions. But the involvement and the opportunity for involvement by the public is usually pretty limited. I mean, most people, I would hazard to say, don't even know exactly what their public utility commission is up to at any given particular time, mm-hmm. and certainly don't even know who the people are who are on it, even though they affect so much of your daily life because they're in charge of seeing how energy is produced. One of the things that we've been very concerned about and interested in is opening up government processes to more public participation and transparency so people know how their government works and how they can get involved. Do you think that your work is replicable?
It's absolutely replicable. The project economics are there, and even where the project economics are tight, there are sources of funding that could be blended into the capital stack to make it feasible. And of course, the incentives through the IRA. It's better if we're able to work with the utility. That's just going to make things so much easier. If they've got programs established that specifically support community solar, so that we're not having to work within the constraints of, you know, a really constrained environment. And I believe that is part of the vision of why Justice 40 Initiative was created with Director Baker's leadership and why the Inflation Reduction Act has such a heavy emphasis on low to moderate income communities and families and working families. And it's interesting, even though I think most of the public isn't actively involved, it feels like folks more and more are starting to think about electricity and where it's coming from. And hopefully we will just continue down this trajectory and with this investment from the public sector and also the interest from the private sector be able to have a transition that's equitable.
Well put. Well, thanks so much, Ajulo, for spending some time today and talking to us about community solar.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information, visit us at progressivereform.org or follow us on Instagram at progressivereform, all one word, or catch up with us on Twitter at CPRblog, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and don't forget to leave us a review. It helps us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guest today, Ajulo Otho, as well as our producer, Maggie DeWayne, and our editor, Courtney Garcia. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.